This is Only a Game. I'm Charlotte Wilder, in for Bill Littlefield. Kevin Cullen has never been to Iceland, but he grew up with a pretty clear impression of the country's people.
I pictured Iceland as these, like, big bullies.
If you were also raised in the 90s, you probably know why.
Iceland physically dominated the first game between these two teams, and they'll try to do it again tonight.
D2, the second and clearly the best movie in Disney's Mighty Ducks trilogy, was released in 1994. It pitted the lovable Ducks against Team Iceland, who were, to quote the Ducks, bigger, stronger, faster, and had more facial hair. Iceland, the bad guys. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has this story.
Iceland, when you grew up in the 90s, all you think of is the Mighty Ducks.
That's Tommy Magelson, who, along with Kevin Cullen and Mike Florek, co-hosts the Quack Attack podcast, the definitive Mighty Ducks podcast. Yes, it's a real thing. For those unfamiliar with the film, Team Iceland isn't your generic sports movie villain. These guys are talented hockey players. They trounce the Ducks 12-1 in their first meeting, and they're scary. They've got a huge Viking logo on their black jerseys. They take cheap shots, and in one particularly dark scene, Iceland's coach comes upon the Ducks playing around with a beach ball.
Picks up the beach ball. He's got this weird, like, smarmy look on his face. He maintains eye contact with the Ducks and just crushes it.
Literally crushes that childish dream.
I remember being so impressed, though, that he crushed a beach ball with his bare hands.
But here's the thing that Kevin, Tommy, and most other Mighty Ducks fans didn't know when they first loaded D2 into their VCRs. Not only is the real Iceland home to at least a few good people, hockey is not popular in the country. At the time D2 came out, Iceland had just joined the International Ice Hockey Federation. There were only two rinks in the entire country, and neither had roofs. Which all leads to one big question.
Why the hell was Iceland picked to be the villain?
That story begins with a man named Steve Brill. After graduating from college in the mid-80s, Steve moved to LA, hoping to make it as a writer. He got some acting roles.
Nothing of note, but you could see me and miss me in many big movies throughout the 80s and 90s.
Back then, Steve lived in a dingy apartment in Culver City. He calls it a hovel.
I was literally looking for quarters in the sofa to go down to the 7-Eleven and get ramen noodles.
Steve didn't have too much going on, so he spent a lot of time skating at a local ice rink. And he got the idea to write a screenplay about a peewee hockey team from Minnesota. This would, of course, become the first Mighty Ducks movie.
Ducks stick together, right?
Yeah!
So let's see it. Show me the Flying V.
I was just thrilled to have a movie that, you know, my parents could go see in New York, my grandmother would see in Miami. I thought that was the coolest thing. And then it became a pretty substantial hit for Disney.
Steve was called in for a meeting with Disney's CEO, Michael Eisner.
He said, I need another Mighty Ducks movie immediately. And I was like, oh, well, you know, that shouldn't be hard. I can do it over the summer. I can do it. I'll probably get it done in 6 months and then we can shoot it. And he was like, no, I need it in 2 weeks. And I remember being smart enough to not say that's insane, but thinking, you can't write a script in 2 weeks. But I didn't say that, and I walked out.
I don't remember the meeting to be exactly that.
That's Mighty Ducks producer Jordan Kerner.
Steve's memory being that he's much younger, maybe sharper than mine.
Is that pretty quick turnaround?
That would be extremely quick, which is why I'm being very polite about it.
So maybe it was a little more than 2 weeks. But regardless, the pressure was on to deliver a worthy sequel. In the first movie, and apologies for giving away the surprise, the ragtag Ducks managed to take down their number one rival, the Hawks, a team of rich suburban kids. For the second movie, the stakes had to be higher. In D2, the Ducks were going to represent Team USA at the fictional Junior Goodwill Games, and they needed an international rival. The obvious choice was Russia.
Although Russia had just gone through glasnost and there was a thawing in relationship.
Things may have changed politically a little since then, but they weren't a villain and we certainly didn't want to encourage anybody looking at them as a villain.
So Russia was out.
So I scanned the globe in my head and my first thought would be, of course, the villains would be the Germans. The Germans are just the go-to from Die Hard to everywhere.
You have me at a loss. You know my name, but who are you?
Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Good evening, Fräulein.
You have no business here, Jamaica.
But after further review and careful consideration, and I can't remember what else except maybe because it was so obvious and I didn't want to pick on the Germans, I put them aside. And then I thought, well, what if we could create another entity that people don't know that much about, and therefore I could have the latitude to create them any way I wanted.
So Steve and Jordan were on the hunt for a cold weather country that people wouldn't know much about, which brings us to a daytime soap opera. Around the same time that Steve was asked to write the second Ducks movie, a TV show called Santa Barbara was finishing a 9-season run. Jordan had become friends with a talented young actress on the show. Her name was Maria Ellingsen.
I'm Maria Ellingsen. I'm born and raised in Iceland.
On the soap, Maria played an East German.
A very innocent German girl who was surprised at seeing bananas, wondering where they grew, and just being so blue-eyed.
I should get going. I've never stayed out for a whole night.
You know, I was sort of tired of being the angelic, blonde, Icelandic woman.
So just when Steve and Jordan were looking for the Ducks' next rival, Maria Ellingsen, from Iceland, was ready for a heel turn. The fates seemed to be aligning.
I remember probably jumping up and down like, Iceland, of course! They're from Iceland! Get it? Iceland!
Except there were some issues. Steve didn't know much about Iceland. He'd never been.
No, this was back in the 90s. I don't think they had airplanes there. I don't think there was a way to get there.
So I'm sure in your early research, you figured out that Iceland was, in fact, not a hockey powerhouse. did you worry that people might call you out on that?
Oh, yeah. That's the other thing. Oh, when I did, that's so funny. I just had to cast that annoying fact aside.
So it was settled. Iceland, population 260,000, no countryman to ever reach the NHL, would be the team to beat, and Maria Ellingsen would join the team's contemptible coaching staff. Steve shot himself up in his new apartment. Thanks to the success of Ducks 1, he had moved out of the hovel, and he wrote. Steve said he met his deadline with minutes to spare, and the movie went into production. The next task? Turning a bunch of young American actors into Icelandic goons.
We all had to dye our hair blonde.
That's Scott White, who was cast to play Team Iceland's star player, Gunnar Stahl. Scott and the rest of the faux Icelanders were given simple instructions.
Look very serious. Just give menacing looks.
But Scott also had some lines. Luckily, Mario was there on set to help with his Icelandic accent. And for a while, that arrangement worked. Here's Scott in an early scene.
Father Tillandskut.
What does that mean?
You'll find out.
But toward the end of filming, when they were shooting some of the most important scenes, Scott was given some new lines that he hadn't been able to practice. Maria wasn't there.
And so it got to that moment where we had to shoot those scenes, and it was like, all right, Scott, let's do this. And so I just sort of went for it, and those lines just sound like I'm completely Russian or something else.
Good work, Captain Duck.
Thanks, Gunner.
And I'm like, good work, Captain Duck. It became like, wait a second, what? Is he Icelandic or Russian? And I think at that time, if you said, hey, here's a map, just point out where Russia is and point out where Iceland is, I think I would have thought maybe they were just right next to each other. I'm not quite sure. I'm not in any way saying that I deserve an Academy Award for that performance.
Maybe not. But still, the co-hosts of the Quack Attack podcast say Team Iceland is one of the best parts of the Ducks trilogy.
I mean, it also gave us an excuse to learn a little bit about Iceland. Like, if this movie hadn't happened, could you give me, like, one fact about Iceland?
Yeah, I'm really curious as to what, like, how did D2 go over in Iceland?
That's a great question.
My name is Helgi Páll Þórisson from Reykjavík, Iceland.
Helgi Páll Þórisson is the vice president of the Icelandic Hockey Federation. He played on Iceland's national hockey team for 10 years. But when D2 Mighty Ducks came out in 1994, Helgi was 16 years old. He says his entire junior team, 25 guys, decided to see the movie in theaters after practice one Friday. They'd heard Iceland was featured.
And I was like super excited. I knew that we were going to be like the bad guys in the movie of a sort. I didn't realize it's going to be portrayed like we crushing the young guys and then the team.
Hold up! Yo! Destroy!
Gotta be 2 minutes.
2 minutes well worth it.
We were like, you know, a little bit disappointed on seeing the Iceland team with just goons just beating the Mighty Ducks up. And of course, the poor Icelandic. And I said, this is not us. We don't do this. No.
Helgi says that after D2 came out, all his friends asked him if hockey was really like that, with guys just beating each other up. Helgi says he told them no, there were more rules in real life. But even so, Helgi says more Icelandic kids started putting on hockey skates. Maria Ellingsen, the actress who played one of Team Iceland's coaches, saw her own niece pick up the sport. She says no one asked her to help coach.
No. I guess my reputation had been ruined.
Soccer, handball, and basketball are still Iceland's most popular sports. But since D2 came out, Iceland got a third ice rink, and the original two got roofs. And just for the record, Helgi Pakthorason says he's never crushed an opponent's beach ball. I asked him if he wanted to say anything to all the Americans who might have grown up with the wrong impression of Icelanders.
Well, my message to American people is basically pack your hockey gear and come over here and play a couple of games with us.
And can you promise that you guys will be kinder to the Americans than the Team Iceland in the movie?
No, I cannot. Just kidding. Yeah, we treat people nice here. It will be fun, I promise you.
Mighty Ducks screenwriter Steve Brill says he's in.
And I will bring a beach ball. And we'll see what happens, man. And then we'll see what happens.
Our investigation into the origin of Team Iceland was produced and reported by our Mighty Ducks Spotlight team leader, Martin Kessler. Dog sled racer Blair Braverman was 6 miles into a training run on a frozen lake in Minnesota, and something was wrong. Her training partner was supposed to be following her, but she was nowhere in sight.
So I turn around, and this is something the dogs do not like turning around. They like going forward. Every time you ask the dogs to do something that they don't understand, you lose a little bit of their trust, and you have to rebuild it.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Hi, I'm Mindy Thomas from NPR's Wow in the World, and this week it's all about Operation Earth. How to be cool to a planet that's getting hot. Check it out with the curious and conscientious kids in your life. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Charlotte Wilder, in for Bill Littlefield, and it is time for 3 stories you should know. Playoff hockey has come to Las Vegas.
The battle rages on 2 fronts, east and west. Warriors clashing to establish a champion.
That is what it sounded like inside T-Mobile Arena before the Vegas Golden Knights first round series against the LA Kings. And that is where we're going to start this week. Joining me is Don Van Natta, senior writer for ESPN. Hey, Don.
Hey, Charlotte. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining me. And we have Nora Princiati, Patriots reporter at the Boston Globe. Hello, Nora.
Hello, Charlotte.
I'm so psyched you guys are here. We're going to start talking about the Golden Knights because I've become particularly obsessed with this team. They swept the Kings this week in the first round of the playoffs, which would be impressive on its own, but is kind of unbelievable given that this is the first year the Knights have existed. They are the first expansion team to do this well, and they're cobbled together from guys whose teams didn't think they were important enough to protect during the expansion draft. And also, after the shooting in Vegas on October 1st, the team has really given people something to rally around. I actually went out there for a game, and I was just really moved by how the community feels that the team has come together to play for them, and the players said that it gives them something bigger than themselves to play for. Don, what do you make of this pretty incredible team and the run they've had?
What I love most of all, Charlotte, is that they were listed in the Vegas sports books before the season at 200-1 odds to win the Stanley Cup. And now they're co-favorites to win at 4-1. And, you know, if they win, the Vegas sports books are going to get crushed because so many local Golden Knights fans have placed bets on them to win at those fat odds. It's like, don't just root for this Cinderella story, root for the Vegas sports books, which always win to lose big. Can you tell I've made a few large deposits at the Vegas sportsbooks?
Don, do you have money on the Knights?
I don't have money on the Knights. I wish I did at 200-1.
Nora, what are your thoughts? You know, the cool thing is that how teams get built tends to be one of these things where sort of the business and gross underbelly elements of sports come together. But the fact that they're all on this team because of the expansion draft and because they came from other places that didn't deem them worthy of protecting, there's kind of that great equalizer, right? Like, you don't have your star that's making so much more money than everybody else.
You know, these guys have just played so well. I mean, William Karlsson, I think, put up the same number of goals by January that he'd put up in 3 years with the Blue Jackets. I mean, just really amazing stuff. All right, our next story, Don, we're going to go to you. I hear you have some thoughts about a recent Boston Marathon runner.
Yes. After a 26-year-old nurse named Sarah Sellers crossed the finish line at the Boston Marathon on Monday, she had a few questions. Like, well, where had she finished? Second, she was told. So then she asked what division, because she felt sure there was no way she had finished second overall. No, she was assured, you finished second. Her time was 2 hours, 44 minutes, and 4 seconds, run in the worst conditions imaginable, a blustery day of freezing horizontal rain. Then she discovered she had won $75,000 in prize money. She had hoped maybe she'd win enough money to cover her trip to Boston from her home in Tucson, Arizona. Now Sellers says she'll use the windfall to put a dent in her student loans. And guys, how's that for an astonishing American success story? Finish second in the Boston Marathon and pay off some of your student loans. Not all of them, just some. It turns out before Boston, she wasn't on anyone's radar screen. She works 10 hours a day as a nurse anesthetist. Boston was only the second marathon of her life. Although she trained hard, Sellers had a relaxed, whatever happens, happens attitude going into Boston. After arriving in New England, she drove up to Maine for some biking with her husband, Blake. You know, guys, this is not how elite runners prepare for the Boston Marathon.
Well, and she'd run in college, but I think she broke her foot and it kind of derailed her running career.
Yes.
And it was really funny because I was covering the marathon and there was this whole kind of hubbub after everybody finished where, you know, the people from Runner's World magazine and the PR staff people, they're running around after the race finishes going, who is Sarah Sellers? Who is this woman? We don't know her. We don't even know where she is. Can somebody find her? And it was just total, I mean, it was chaos, but it was really fun, wonderful, sort of inspiring chaos.
The thing about the Boston Marathon is it's one of my favorite days every year. I find it very moving. And I always, there's this moment where I'm like, well, maybe I'll do it. Maybe I'll try to run a marathon. And then followed, you know, very quickly, 5 minutes later, I'm like, oh, I'm never going to do that. But for someone like Sarah Sellers, who maybe had that thought, was like, well, guess I'll run a marathon. And then to come in second, I mean, that's like incredible.
I love this story. I think it's the best sports story of the year. I think her secret of her success certainly is that grit, and she needs that grit in her professional life.
Yeah.
So I think that that was also, in a way, preparation for the conditions that she had to face.
Right.
But I also think part of it was just her relaxed, whatever happens, happens approach. You know, it sort of shows you the benefit in life of low expectations or even no expectations to sometimes exceed them.
Yeah. Maybe we should all just try to believe in ourselves a little less. Just like, go
yes.
for it.
Right. Set a low bar and you can hop over it.
Right.
Speaking of low bars, or maybe high bars, I'm really not sure what this one is. Nora, can you tell us about a certain horse running the Kentucky Derby that shares a name with a very famous football player here in New England?
Charlotte, I am so glad that you asked. So the Kentucky Derby is coming up on May 5th, and Gronkowski the horse will be running. Gronkowski the horse qualified for the Kentucky Derby recently by winning a race in England called the Burridon Stakes. And there is video on YouTube of his finish and hearing this breathless announcer saying, and I'm not going to do a British accent, I can't do it.
Come on.
But Gronkowski's coming around the final turn. Gronkowski! Gronkowski's in the lead!
But it's Gronkowski doing enough. Could he be Kentucky Derby bound?
Gronkowski's won the Burridon Stakes. He is Kentucky Derby bound! Is like one of the funniest things I've heard in my entire life. But Gronkowski, he was purchased by a woman named Carrie Radcliffe, who is not so much an American football fan as she is a fan of Tom Brady. For aesthetic reasons, I'll say. And she wanted to name a horse Brady, but she got one look at this colt and said, well,
He's not built like Brady. He's built like Gronkowski. He's a very muscly bay colt. You fast forward to now, and Gronkowski's going to the Derby, and the photo op where Gronk is part of the group that walks from the barn to the track and from the track to the paddock is going to be just one for the ages. This horse is a long shot. He's never run on dirt. He's never run more than a mile. He's going to be significantly overbet because... yeah. People just want to get in on the fun. I've already gotten some emails from people asking for anonymity in this, but telling me that they've set aside a certain dollar amount, just under $70, to bet on the horse.
Oh, my God.
And the thing is that this affects the odds for the other horses in the race. So then you've got the racing people saying, well, this is screwing up our big event, this tradition, and it's just such an odd couple.
It's truly beautiful. Don, if you had to name a horse after an NFL player, what would your what would your call be?
Oh, it has to be Gronk. This is it's official. This is maximum Gronk. I thought we had maximum Gronk with the Gronk Cruise or maybe the Gronk Bruin Stanley Cup party when he spiked the puck on the ice. All of those things pale in comparison to Gronk the horse running in the Kentucky Derby. Of course, the horse is not going to win, but yes, I agree. The optics of Gronk, and by the way, Gronk always goes to the Kentucky Derby with Tom Brady.
Right.
So the idea of Gronk and Tom Brady together at Churchill Downs the first Saturday of May cheering on Gronk as he likely finishes last is going to be just so much fun to see.
I mean, what's he going to wear?
Right. Oh, he's going to wear like some horrible Madras or seersucker suit and a straw hat, and he's gonna look like a total doofus, and I am so excited for this. I think that Gronk standing with Gronk the horse is just, it's something we could only dream about.
We'll find out who's taller. It's a matter of some debate. 6'6" is Gronk. The horse might come in at 6'5".
All right. Well, thank you guys so much for joining me. Don, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Charlotte.
And Nora, just an absolute delight. You guys are the best.
So fun.
That's the Boston Globe's Nora Princiati and ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr.
My husband used to be into horses. He worked as a cowboy, and now I've transformed him into a dog musher, and he doesn't know what happened. His name is Quince Mountain, and my name is Blair Braverman, so we call our dogs Braver Mountain Mushing.
Blair and Q, as everyone calls her husband, live in Wisconsin. Dog sled racing requires long apprenticeships because you have to learn how to care for the dogs and get them to trust you. Even though she's been mushing for 11 years, Blair only got her own team of 23 dogs a few years ago.
I can't imagine I ever didn't have my own dogs. It's like the difference between babysitting and having your own kids.
Full disclosure, Blair and I went to college together. We used to sit next to each other in our poetry writing classes, and I remember being stunned by her ability to tell a story with these stripped-down lyrical stanzas. She could, and still can, punch you in the gut with her words. She just qualified for next year's Iditarod at a recent 440-mile race in Alaska, and she's written a book about her experiences mushing called Welcome to the Goddamn Ice Cube. She tells her stories on social media.
So I share the dog team on Twitter, and people follow them closely, and they know the dogs. I tell these stories of, you know, just beautiful things. And if I'm sharing the sport with people and giving them an inside glimpse, I can't cherry pick. But when something like this happens, and it's the worst day I've had, certainly the worst day in the sport that I've had, I'm scared to tell people. It feels like a story of my own failure.
It happened in Minnesota this winter, where Blair and Q had taken the dogs to train.
We were training our yearlings, and we wanted to work with the dogs to cross lakes and to go on hills, which are two things we don't have a ton of near our house. So we thought, oh, wow, there's this beautiful route up in Minnesota, and we can go up and do like a 200-mile camping trip with the dogs. There's beautiful hills. That's up where the Sawtooth Mountains are. There's just miles and miles of lakes.
They met their friend Mary at a bush plane lodge on a 6-mile lake called Devil's Trap. Mary's also a musher, and she was helping Blair and Q train their dogs. Mary took one of their teams, led by Blair's dog Jenga, who Blair is very close with. Blair took the other team, led by Peppy and Bodica. Q was going to meet them down the trail at the end of the run, where they'd camp for the night.
So I set out first, and then I was going to try to stay as slow as possible so that her dogs could chase mine and learn how to cross the lake that way. And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful day. Like, it couldn't be more perfect. Just blue sky, and it's like 0 degrees, which is, you know, perfect for sled dogs. And they're like yelping and wagging their tails and just so excited to be out there. They love new terrain. It really is exciting for them.
Blair tried to slow the pace to wait for Mary. She was riding the brakes so hard that she was sending up sheets of snow behind her, and the dogs were getting frustrated. They live to go fast. They eventually crossed the full 6 miles of lake, but Blair still couldn't see Mary and her team anywhere in the distance. She worried that if she went farther, Mary wouldn't be able to find them. Blair tried to send her a text, but in the 0 degree cold, her phone immediately died.
So I turn around, and this is something the dogs do not like turning around. They like going forward. They're very forward-oriented, and they don't like going back where they've come. So I call up to Peppy and Bodica.
Peppy was not happy about Blair's commands. She gave Blair an annoyed look, but obliged, and pulled the team into a big U-turn, so they were heading back in the direction they came from.
What do you know, but within, like, 30 seconds, I see another dog team, and Mary made it onto the ice, and she's just fine. So Mary and I pass each other going opposite directions in the middle of the ice. And she's like, what's going on? And I'm like, don't worry, just keep going. We'll turn around again. The dogs are, they're getting confused. Every time you ask the dogs to do something that they don't understand, you lose a little bit of their trust. And you have to rebuild it. And I'm talking about over life, but also over the course of a single run. So the dogs are skeptical of me now. And I'm like, okay, we've got to turn around again. Sorry about this. I promise we won't do it again. So we're in the ice, and I'm calling Peppy to turn around, and Peppy's a little bit annoyed, so she makes a sharper turn than she should. But all of a sudden, the dog in swing, which is right behind the leaders, attacks Bodica. And this dog's name is Gabby. And Gabby just goes for Bodica's throat. In 10 years, I haven't seen a dog go for another dog like this. It doesn't make any sense. Bodica's down on the ice in a second. I run straight into the fight, and Gabby won't stop. It's terrifying. And Gabby, I cannot get Gabby to take her teeth out of Bodica. And Bodica's on the ice, and she's screaming, and I'm screaming, and, you know, there's blood on the snow. And I'm sort of, at the same time, just using my arms and pulling the other dogs away and making sure they stay safe and yelling at Gabby and trying to pull her off, and she just will not release her teeth. She's just decided to kill Bodica. And Bodica wasn't fighting back. She was lying, you know, on her back with her belly up, trying to be submissive. So I'm using all my strength in my body to pull Gabby off Bodica. Sled dogs are very strong. They're bodybuilders. So I'm doing everything I can, and then I'm sort of gasping for breath and trying to make sure I don't, like, pass out from fighting so hard to keep these dogs apart.
Gabby hadn't ever gone after another dog, but she typically didn't get along with other girls that well. Blair later found out that a pack of wolves had been on the ice hours before, which also could have riled Gabby up. There were many variables outside of Blair's control besides asking the dogs to turn around.
And, what I ended up doing was just throwing my body over Bodica. I was desperate to stop Bodica from being hurt. And I wasn't thinking about myself. I just knew that if Bodica was covered by my body, she would be safe. And whatever happened to me, I would deal with. That ended up working. When she was covered by me and Gabby couldn't reach her, that was when Gabby finally stopped. So we reach this impasse. Bodica is, you know, just limp under me, and I'm afraid to stand up because I'm afraid that the moment I do, Gabby's going to go back for her. And so I'm just lying over Bodica, and I don't know what to do. And I see this dot in the distance. Jenga, my leader who was on Mary's team, saw that I wasn't coming and pulled Mary's team around to come back to me.
Blair was relieved to have help, but terrified of what might happen if the other team ran into hers while tensions were still so high. So far, none of her other dogs had gotten involved, but she didn't know what would happen with more.
And I'm sort of still over Bodica, and I yell at Mary when she gets close to stop her team. You know, just stop right there. Don't come any closer. And then I sort of gather my strength, and I wrap my arms around Bodica, who's beneath me, and I stand up and lift her up with me in one movement. So she goes from being underneath me to in my arms.
Blair knew that she had to get Bodica away from Gabby and back to Q. She didn't know what damage had been done, whether Bodica's internal organs had been hurt or if her injuries were just surface wounds.
You know, she's bleeding a lot and she's licking my face. And I lay her down in Mary's sled and I tell Mary, go back. Just go as fast as you can.
Mary and her team headed back to the lodge. Gabby was standing there on the ice, still snarling. Blair let some of the yearlings loose, trusting they wouldn't run away, and moved Gabby to the back of the team between some of the boy dogs. She hooked the team back up and started making her way, very slowly, back to the lodge in Bodica. When she got back to the lodge, she picked her up. Mary and Q had wrapped the dog in blankets.
You know, she just sort of melts into my arms when I get back, and I feel like I don't deserve it, but I also just want her to know. I know that you just went through the worst part of your life, Bodica, that you've ever had, and we don't know how hurt you are. And we don't even know if you're going to survive. But I want you to know I was out there with you every second, doing everything I could possibly do.
Bodica had a lot of skin wounds, but she was responsive, licking Blair and Q's faces when they came near. She seemed okay.
And then she pees blood, and my heart sank.
The nearest vet was in Duluth, so they loaded up the dogs in the truck and sped the 2 hours south, arriving around midnight. The vet x-rayed Bodica and couldn't find her bladder. Blair and Q, panicked at this point, took her to a vet across town who had an ultrasound. It turns out that since sled dogs are so lean, they don't have the same layers of fat around all their organs that pet dogs do. The first vet wasn't used to seeing a dog as muscular as Bodica, so she missed her bladder. But the ultrasound showed that it was there and intact, which meant she had a good chance of healing. Blair and Q took Bodica and the rest of the team back home to Wisconsin.
And so we bring Bodica inside, and she just, for a couple days, she doesn't move. And then she starts drinking, and the best thing was when I realized that she was snooping around our house because she doesn't normally live in the house, but she started collecting things. So we're finding things in her bed, like, you know, my camera or an apple that she got off the counter, or just, she's just starting to collect things. And that was like the moment when I knew she was going to be okay. She healed up beautifully.
As much as she loved her, Blair knew she couldn't keep Gabby. You can't have a dog on your team that puts others in danger. Blair found her a new home with a musher who loves her and who only has boy dogs. Gabby still runs, which makes Blair feel better about letting her go. She didn't think she'd be very happy as a pet. Blair was nervous about telling this story.
I don't think there's a way that I could have known, but I wish that I could have kept her from being hurt at all. Of course, a dog got hurt on my watch, and that's the worst feeling. And I blame myself for that, and, you know, I'm afraid of other people blaming me too, that other people will blame me as much as I blame myself.
But it's not a story about blame or about failure. At its core, it's a story about trust and about how much we can't control even when we try our hardest. On that day, something went horribly wrong, but Blair and her team got through it together. No other dogs attacked when Gabby lunged. None ran away when Blair loosed them from her sled. They stayed with her. Everyone else, the other team of dogs, Mary, Jenga, Q, the vets, rose to the occasion. Blair's hellish experience on the heavenly expanse of Devil's Trap Lake, and her life in general, isn't something a lot of people will ever know. Especially now, when most of us live in tamed environments. But that day on the ice, everything was stripped away, and Blair and the dogs could only rely on their animal instincts and on each other. It was primal, painful, raw, and real. even ugly. And there's something beautiful about that. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Are you funnier than Fallon? More amusing than Aziz? More clever than Click and Clack? Well, if you've got an idea that'll make people laugh, enter WBUR's Next Great Show contest for a chance to get your show on the air. To find out more, go to WBUR.org/nextgreatshow.
I'm Charlotte Wilder, filling in for Bill Littlefield, and it's time to talk about this week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Charlotte.
Joel Embiid is back. The Philadelphia 76ers star played for the first time in a month after he broke his face on teammate Markel Fultz in the regular season. Is this ex-GM Sam Hinkie's the process, dare we say it, working?
Well, I mean, if you tank for 4 or 5 years and you don't draft dead people,
your team
will get better, okay? This is not something Sam Hinkie invented.
Charlie, tell me how you really feel.
But Joel Embiid has been a star in the making since he was a freshman at Kansas.
Yeah.
He's enormously talented. He just hasn't had any luck.
Yeah.
I mean, all he did the whole time he was injured was complain about it.
Do you follow him on social media?
Oh, of course, yeah.
I love it. I love it so much. He just sort of rips into everybody. And even the Sixers, when he posted something on his Instagram story that said, "I'm tired of being bleeping babied."
Yes.
The Sixers were just like,
"You broke your face, dude." Yeah. You know?
They were also like, "Well, that's
nobody's
Joel
babying you."
So here we go. The Rockets beat the Timberwolves on Wednesday night, but James Harden only made 2 of his 18 shots. Should they be worried?
He's certainly not. He said, you know, he'll be back. You know, it's one of those nights where you wonder, you know, why did you take the 15th shot? You know, you're already 2 for 14.
Just take
yourself
out.
You're already 2 for 14. Do other stuff until you're feeling better.
He did play some defense, too,
yes,
which was nice. The Celtics' Terry Rozier called the Bucks guard Eric Bledsoe Drew during a news conference, which is some incredible shade after the Celtics beat the Bucks in game 1 of the playoffs. And Bledsoe said, "I don't even know who the bleep that is," when he was asked about Rozier. I think basketball drama is the best drama, and I kind of hope they keep it going.
That, first of all, that is really deep shade, because you've got to remember, I don't know how old Terry Rozier was when Drew Bledsoe played quarterback,
right,
for the Patriots. And then, of course, for Bledsoe to come back saying, "I don't even know who he is," well, I mean, I can understand that, because he didn't see very much of him as Terry Rozier was blowing by him in the first 2 games.
Right. Calling someone the wrong name, I think, is one of the sneaky sort of most disrespectful things you can do.
Uh-huh.
Did you ever watch Bruno Sammartino wrestle?
Yes, I did. That was back in the black and white era of professional wrestling with Chief J. Strongbow,
yeah,
and Professor Turo Tanaka. Yeah, he was the first real superstar wrestler of my lifetime. I'm sure back in the 30s and 40s there were others. Honest to God, I didn't know he was still alive until he passed away this week.
He did.
I had not heard about it.
He did. He was 82. So many of the wrestlers today, like The Rock, John Cena, they all said that he was the guy who inspired them. And he became a color commentator in WWE, but he left the company. He walked away. He was disillusioned with the drug use, steroid use, and he wouldn't even let them induct him into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, he believed in the basic integrity of performance sports,
yes,
shall we say.
Here's a good one. The London Marathon has urged people to, quote, "reconsider fancy costumes in record heat," which I didn't realize this. Apparently, people dress up for the London Marathon a lot, even though running a marathon seems hard enough, let alone dressed like an elephant or something. But it's only going to be 74 degrees. Do you think they're overreacting?
Well, it's record heat if you're dressed like an elephant or a phone booth.
Charlie, I want to know, if you were running a marathon, what you would dress up as.
A dead person. And I would absolutely not need a costume by the 12th mile.
You would just be a dead person.
I would be a dead person,
That's
yes.
That's great. That's really uplifting. The Reds fired their manager, Brian Price, this week. Team has been struggling. They have really abysmal pitching. They've made some incredibly terrible trades over the past few years, and the fans are pretty unhappy. Do you think firing Price is going to do anything?
Well, I mean, it'll keep the fans who are not showing up at the ballpark happy in their Barca loungers,
right,
for a few days, but this team just doesn't have any talent.
I know.
It's going to be a 4 or 5 year rebuilding plan for these guys.
That makes me sad. I mean, not really. I don't have a horse.
I was going to say, are you a lifelong Cincinnati Reds fan?
I just get sad for sad fans, you know?
The Ringer's Kevin Clark recently wrote a piece that I found super interesting. He wrote about how the Browns have considered potentially drafting two quarterbacks because they have the first round first pick and the first round fourth pick. I mean, it's just ridiculous, but at the same time,
First of all, it's the Browns. They've right. probably considered drafting anything, anyone. They've probably considered drafting Beyonce
yeah.
at this point. Who it's wouldn't? The Browns. They'll do anything. So sure, why not? Why not draft two quarterbacks? Somebody has to do it sooner or later.
Maybe you should be the quarterback for the
no,
Browns.
No, thank you. If I'm going to die, it's going to be in the London Marathon.
That's right. Sorry, you've already died in the marathon. So the Racing Sausages, those guys dressed up, or women, dressed up as hot dogs at Miller Park, fell in a chain reaction during the Brewers game recently. And I'm actually surprised that these guys don't fall over more often.
Let's get the real sports stuff out of the way here. It left a two-horse race, and the Polish Sausage won in the wire. The Bratwurst and Chorizo piled up, and one of them lost a shoe. And I don't know if that means they had to take the sausage back out and shoot it or grill it or something.
Charlie.
But it's not as good as the Racing Presidents at the National Games.
I like the Racing Sausages more than the Racing Presidents.
No, I love the Racing Presidents because Terry Roosevelt never wins.
It's true. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins Bill Littlefield each week here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Charlotte.
Subscribe to Only a Games podcast. You can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the other places podcasts live. You should also totally leave a review. A good one. Susie Walsham was always gifted. It was clear that she was going places, but she never thought her running career would take her in the direction it did. Thanks to a few unexpected twists and turns, Susie has found herself at the top of her sport. Literally. Noam Osband has the story.
You're in a quite enclosed area, so it can get a little bit stuffy.
Susie Walsham spends a lot of time in stairwells. She's kind of an expert.
It's not always super clean. The air's not always nice and fresh.
Her story actually starts outdoors, on a track. She grew up in Australia and began running at age 6. At age 15, she made the World Junior Championships. But even with all this success, she had a problem.
I was quite injury prone. I had a lot of stress fractures, so I've had 14 stress fractures and one broken foot.
Susie took a break for a few years, but she wasn't ready to give up running for good. And in 2006, she achieved a life goal of representing Australia in a major international competition, the Commonwealth Games. But that old problem kept reappearing. While training for the Commonwealth Games, Susie noticed pain below her left knee. She put off treatment till after the competition.
So then I went and had an MRI, and it showed that the bone was cracked a third of the way through. And so the doctor was like, well, we weren't expecting that. But he sort of said, look, this is really interesting. Do you mind if I keep this scan to show to my students? Because we don't see injuries like this every day. So that was the last stress fracture I had.
Susie stopped running competitively. She was in her early 30s and decided to focus on her career. She's an accountant, and she moved to Singapore for her job.
I saw an advertisement for this vertical race in Singapore.
And this is where the stairs come in, because vertical races take place in the stairwells of skyscrapers.
And the first prize was a trip to New York to come and do the Empire State Building Run. I kind of thought, oh, I haven't been to New York for, 15 years. Oh, it's like a holiday. And oh, yeah, I have to do a race, but let's not worry about that. Let's go on a holiday. At that point, I only lived in a 17-story building. So I was living on the fifth floor, so I could only train between the fifth and the 17th. So I was doing 12 flights at a time.
This race was 73 floors. And Susie wasn't quite ready for that.
I remember the last 30 floors were really, really super tough. And all I was thinking about was New York, New York, keep going. You gotta go to New York.
Not only did she keep going, she smashed the record in the process. And winning meant she got that free trip to New York to run up the Empire State Building.
When you actually see the building in person, it looks like it's a mile. It looks so tall. And I really had no expectation of how I would go, and I won, which surprised me a lot.
In some ways, vertical running is harder than regular track. Your heart rate is higher, and you get more lactic acid buildup. But there's one huge advantage, the key advantage, really.
You're usually landing sort of 2 to 3 times your body weight flat on the ground. So there's a lot of impact going through your body.
But with vertical running, it's different.
When you're landing, you're not landing with your full force of your body. So there's much, much less impact.
And for someone with a history of running injuries, this was a godsend.
My body didn't then have to deal with the bone injuries and the stress fractures that I was getting. So I could basically train all the time.
And so, without planning on it, Susie found a way to prolong her competitive career by becoming a champion vertical runner. The sport is low impact, but that doesn't mean it's no impact. There's one particular Empire State run that stands out.
Yeah, the 2009 one is... It was a tough one.
Welcome from Australia, Susie Walsham.
And I was thrown off balance just straight after the gun by the girl standing next to me. And I was just about to enter the stairwell and I got shoved from the side and I slammed into the wall, smashed up my face, smashed up my knee and crumpled to the floor. My lip puffed up. You know, I was getting married 6 weeks later and I was just remember thinking, oh no, I've broken my nose and I've got all this terrible bruising. My first thought was, my race is over. That's it. It's done. And the next thing I know, someone's picked me up and pushed me through into the stairwell. So I spent the first sort of two or three floors trying to sort of run my tongue through my mouth, checking if I still had teeth, because I remember thinking, well, if I've lost my teeth, I'm going to have to come back down at the end and try and find them. So I better remember, you know, where I think I've lost them. But I thought, you know what, I'm in the stairwell now. Let's keep going for a bit and see how we go.
Fellow competitors described hearing her sobs grow louder as Susie ran closer to overtake them.
Kept going. And then I caught the leader probably around the 65th, 66th floor.
And she held that lead. She won. She still had all her teeth. And as for her face...
Yes, it did heal in time for the wedding.
Susie Walsham became a mom the following year in 2010. She used vertical running as a way to get back in shape after giving birth, which explains why, 5 months after having her kid, she ran, yet again, up the Empire State Building's nearly 1,600 steps. She's kept running, and she's now the world's top-ranked female vertical runner.
That's reporter Noah Mosband. Susie Walsham plans to be back in New York next February when she'll go for her 10th Empire State run-up win. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Dave Souza. Our senior producer is Karen Gibbon. In our final word, Blair Braverman tells me what she's learned from dog sled racing.
It's taught me to stop trying to control what hasn't happened yet and trust that instead I'll tackle it with the tools I have, and it's just not worth trying to predict because I can't.
God, I could use some of that. I'm going to tattoo that on my arm. I'm going to get that embroidered on a pillow and like a jean jacket. I'm Charlotte Wilder. Bill Littlefield will return next week with more sports on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.